Hello, everybody. Welcome back to this episode of The War Room, the interview series brought to you as part of the Clone Star Pod. I am your host, Mike Overton, and joining me this week is an incredible storyboard artist, revisionist, and assistant director, and has worked on some incredible shows such as Puss in Boots, Harley Quinn, and Boy is Diabolical, and a really small show that no one's ever heard of before called Star Trek Lower Decks. My guest this week is the incredible Gene Kang. Gene, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Brilliant. So let's start at the beginning. How did you get into animation?
Let's see. Well, I grew up with watching a lot of anime when I was a kid. So my parents used it as I was born here. My parents are immigrants from Korea. And there in LA, there's been a really big Koreatown, and there used to be a video rental place where my parents and grandparents would rent Korean dramas, and they would rent Korean translated anime for me and my brother. So it was a way of giving us something to interact with that was in Korean, and so that we could retain speaking and listening and understanding Korean. And it worked for me. In a way, I can still speak Korean and understand Korean pretty well, but like it definitely also had the other aspect of getting really obsessed with animation and getting obsessed with art. Like I got like one of the first things I watched was Dragon Ball and like the, you know, original old OG little kid Goku Dragon Ball. I watched a lot of mecha anime. I watched Ranma 1/2. There was a lot of magical girl shows in the 70s and 80s that were like short form series. Like, I think it was like Creamy Mammy, Magical Emmy was like a big one for me. Pelsia, stuff like that. So I really got into watching a lot of anime when I was a kid. I also watched, you know, the typical Disney films. I watched 80s animation. Gem and the Holograms was like a favorite. Rainbow Bright was a big favorite. Strawberry Shortcake, Care Bears. Things like that, Ninja Turtles. Like my brother and I watched a lot of TV when we were kids, but definitely kept it mostly to animation and cartoons. You know, typical 80s, 90s kids.
Yeah, I think we all did, didn't we? Though us 80s, 90s kids watched a lot of animation. I mean, for me, it was always Spider-Man and Batman and Superman, and then, exactly, you know, other bits on the side. But yeah, no, definitely. So did you always want to work in animation? I mean, what did you want to do as a child?
It changed a lot. When I was a kid, I thought all I really wanted to do was draw. And it's one of those, like, you know, you draw, every kid draws because that's how you learn certain motor skills. So every kid is encouraged to draw, and then eventually they either just stop drawing and get more interested in other things. And I just sort of kept drawing because I just really enjoyed it. Like my dad would bring home huge piles of scratch paper from work, and we'd have a scratch paper closet, and I would just reach in there and decimate piles and piles of scratch paper by just drawing on it. And like, so for a long time, it wasn't really animation, because when I saw the process of what animation is, I was like, that's too much drawing. That's too much. Like, it was also like too much minutia, in my opinion. And I was definitely more interested in big epic stories and things like that. Like all of the shows I was really into had some sort of arc. So yeah. I was more in, and also I was getting into comics and graphic novels, manga at the time. Manga was a big, big influence. And compared to like TV and videos that you have to like pause and it was like shaky. Yeah. I could just take open the manga and I can copy all the drawings in there. And like, it was really cool whenever my dad somehow managed to bring tracing paper home, because then I would trace my favorite mangas and stuff with the tracing paper. So for a long time, I think I wanted to be a comic book artist, a graphic novelist, manga artist, stuff like that. Like I had like a sort of a vision of being like someone like Rumiko Takahashi, who created Ranma, or Naoko Takeuchi, like other great female manga artists. I was like, oh, gotcha. That'd be so cool.
So How did you make that then leap from wanting to be a manga artist or a graphic novelist to then working into animation? I mean, you went to college. Mm-hmm. What did you study at college?
I went to Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. I studied illustration. Around that time, sort of entertainment design and entertainment illustration started becoming majors there, where you could learn the behind the scenes of how to draw entertainment, like the character design, environment design, prop design, things like that. It was more geared towards, because the people who influenced it, Sid Mead was a really big influence, because he was a graduate of Art Center. And of course, you know, Blade Runner is timeless classic. Sid Mead and a lot of people who followed Sid Mead were more active in like live action, science fiction, video games, like more realistic stuff. And I was, you know, interested, but I wasn't really interested in super realistic design. I feel realism can be a little bit limiting. So, I mean, I did, but I was interested, so I did it. And after a while, when I was like, oh, I have to really start thinking about what I want to do, I realize I'm not very good at being an adult and figuring.
It's fine.
Yeah, like figuring things out about like health insurance and retirement and all that difficult things, intangible things. And when you're a comic book artist, you really rely on, you have to be really self-reliant and being able to do freelancing and really basically being a small business all unto yourself. And I was like, you know, in my late teens, early 20s brain, I was like, that is beyond my capabilities. But that's when you have to start thinking about it. When you're going to college, they expect you to have all that shit figured out. And I was like, no, that's way too hard. And then I was like, well, what can I do? And I was like, and then I poked around and I found out that animation has a guild and a union. And like, once you get in the union, there's a lot of that 401k health insurance stuff that you just have to sign up for. And I was like, that is a lot easier than having to try to figure out all that stuff on my own. So I didn't really switch gears, but just sort of leaned more towards that direction.
Okay, gotcha. So taking a short break then from your career and early life, how did you get into Star Trek?
So let's see. The thing is, like Star Trek, I've always been aware of it. But, you know, when you're growing up as a kid of immigrant parents, you don't really watch a lot of like the core 90s, 80s, 60s, 70s films, TV shows, like all the things that people quote. I didn't watch Star Wars until my adulthood, and I also sort of saw them in order. Like I saw the prequels first because I saw them in the movie theater. And then, yeah, so I saw them in the order George Lucas intended.
Yes. So you watched it one through one, two, three, then four, yeah. Five, six, instead of four, five, yeah. Six, one, two, three. Gotcha.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, it's something I was always aware of was there, but I was always more interested in animation. Like, if it was animated, I'd immediately be a lot more interested. In fact, I probably saw Clone Wars, the Gennady Tartakovsky Clone Wars, even before I saw actual Star Wars movies, depending on timing of it. But, like, yeah, so Star Trek only had the animated series.
Yeah.
And even then, the animated series, I don't think was airing anywhere when I was young.
No.
If it was in the late 80s, early 90s, I don't remember seeing Star Trek as an animated series on. And we couldn't watch we weren't allowed to watch a lot of live action stuff unless it was very obviously for kids. When I was a child, I had friends who were Trekkies, but like not, you know, like my closest friend who was a Trekkie actually moved away when we were both in elementary school. We still keep contact today, but Yeah, like I've known everyone, I've known people who are Trekkies. It just wasn't their most obvious fandom at the time.
Right.
So I did watch the Kelvin movies when they came out. I watched all of them. So, and then like when I got this job, it was because I knew Barry, our supervising director. Like we've been friends for years, and he came and he's like, "So how much Star Trek have you watched?" And I was like, "Not really a lot, to be honest with you." And he's like, "Oh, that's fine. You know, you're coming in. It's I feel like it's, you know, I'm another point of view for an audience because Lower Decks, yeah, is very reference heavy, but also even if you don't get the references, a lot of the stuff we do is really funny. And, you know, like I feel like our storylines are still easy to follow. And so I was like, well, now I'm on this show. It's the pandemic. I can't go anywhere. Time to watch a lot of Star Trek. And so I've been making my way through TNG. And that's when it really started. That's when I started being like much more appreciative of it. Because a lot of the things I was into, especially when I was younger, I was really big into hero's journey,
Yep.
kind of mythological storytelling, stuff like that. And so Star Trek, I didn't quite understand the appeal when I was younger because I felt like, you know, no one takes out a sword and swings it.
There's no
They
swords
tried
in this
to
show. I'm not watching it. Okay, fair enough.
try diplomacy first.
Yes.
How lame.
But I suppose when you're a kid, that is a bit lame, isn't it, really? So,
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was always a case of, oh, they're flying around in space. That's incredible. And the rest of it, I didn't really care about. But yeah. But then I
Yeah, it's
was.
when you grow up with a lot of mecha anime, yeah, you fly around in space, but there's also robots and they
Well, yeah.
transform.
Well, there was a whole Star Trek Transformers thing, but we're going to glaze over
So
that.
it's only now as an adult that I really appreciate, especially now of all times, I really appreciate what Star Trek brings. But I think you know, I wasn't mature enough as a kid. A lot of people were much more mature than I am. As a kid. Even now, I'm not sure if I'm mature enough, but like a lot, it's like I appreciate it. I appreciate it so much more now because I can see the goodness and the kindness and the thoughtfulness that goes into Star Trek, which I, that's something I appreciate the most.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's skip over the Star Trek bit for the moment then. So you've just finished college. What was your first job in animation? Where did you start?
First job in animation, I was a production assistant at a flash animation studio called Animax. And it was there I met a young editor who's also was his first job. His name was Barry J. Kelly.
I've got no idea who that is.
Yeah. I also met a character designer named Mike Maglio, who also worked on the show. Yeah, there's but yeah, it was a back when like flash animation was still was kind of big and everyone was trying to do it. And it was a place, it was interesting. It was an interesting job. I got in, worked on an adult TV show for about 2 weeks and then got laid off and then got hired again. It was very funny. Like I was, they had me looking up photos of a wrestler. And so it looked like I was looking at sweaty naked men on my screen when they came in to tell me that I was being laid off.
It could have been worse. I mean, many other things you could be looking at that are way worse.
I was there as a production assistant for 2 years. Didn't stay a production assistant. I moved up. I did a lot of illustration stuff. I became a junior illustrator. I did designs. Basically, like, I'm a pretty flexible artist. I'm able to do a lot of different things. I can do color. I can do character design. I can do background design. I can do storyboarding. I can do some basic animation. You know, I can build flash libraries of characters, like a, you know, like a little paper doll with joints and stuff, but in a computer. So things like that. And so when you're in a small studio like that, your job role isn't always defined. They can just sort of throw you to places. I also did some voice acting for them. I was Rainbow Bright for them, which was interesting. So I am legit a voice actress of Rainbow Bright because I was paid for
There we
it.
go.
And so yeah, I was there for 2 years, and the recession hit, and that's when we were all laid off.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was my
Fun
first job
times.
in animation.
So, okay, so you obviously got laid off from there. Where did you go next?
Let's see. I did freelance. I freelance a little bit for a studio called Oddbot, doing Club Penguin things.
Okay. Oh, when
I
that was a
worked
thing.
a
God, I remember Club Penguin.
right. Yeah, we did some commercials for Club Penguin, so that was interesting. I also they would Animax here and there would call me back to do some freelance. There was something called Where's My Water? That was a Disney project. It was about an alligator looking for water.
Okay. Sounds interesting.
Yeah. So I did some freelance here and there. I worked on another show for a little bit. I don't remember what that show was called. I was over at 6 Point Harness. I did a lot of conventions during that time. I went back to school for a little bit. I went to a small school called Concept Design Academy, which is great. I highly recommend that people go there as because it's taught by professionals. So that's when I really learned how to storyboard and really learned cinematography, film language, and things like that.
Gotcha.
Let's see. But yeah, I was pretty much unemployed for about 2 years aside from freelance gigs. I was part of this really great anthology series called Womanthology.
Okay.
I got to draw a comic for Gail Simone, and we still talk to this day.
Wow.
Gail Simone and I are buds. I'm very proud of that. She's awesome. I love her. Let's see. And then I got hired at Titmouse, because of a connection I made, like a lot of mutual friends. Like big thing about animation, entertainment jobs in general, but it's like a huge thing is networking. And networking in animation, I sort of call it like friends you haven't met yet. Because like animation people are really nerdy and we all like the same things. We like real obscure nerdy things, like specific niche anime. So we sort of bond over that. I feel like, we're all sort of the kids in school who are just like, yeah, she just liked them weird Japanese comics and stuff. So like yeah, we all sort of I wonder if we trauma bond over over that we have mutual niche interests. So
That.
yeah, I met a producer over at Titmouse named Will Fang, and he was working they were working on a project with Amazon where this was before Amazon Prime and they started their streaming service. This was something they were experimenting with. They were trying to do some sort of like if you try making animatics, like really posed out animatics that
Yep.
are colored, and then they put it up on Amazon and people watch it and they're able to sort of crowdsource opinions on it, but not realizing that animatics are really hard for people who don't know how to watch an animatic to watch.
Oh yeah, if it's new
Yeah.
to you, you just come across and go, "What is this?"
Yeah. But they hired me. I tested. They paid me for the test because it was also freelance. They hired me for a princess movie, and the director for that was Sung Jin An, and he's the I think supervising director of Vox Machina right now. So that was my first job after the recession. That was like my first job. And that was also my first job as like a storyboard artist.
Right.
And it was storyboarding some because they saw that I've always really loved musicals. So
It
I
doesn't.
story yeah, I know. Who doesn't? Certain people, but
No, everyone deep down loves a musical. They just refuse to admit it.
think that's true too. But yeah, I had a teacher who told me that he's like, you don't have enough animals in your portfolio. And I was like, okay. And so I did a musical sequence based on the musical The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Okay.
But I made everyone an animal. So like the Scarlet Pimpernel and his love interests were cats. There was the main antagonist is a falcon because he sings a song called Falcon in the Dive. So I was just like, easy. So yeah, things like that. I was like, well, if I have to draw animals, I'm gonna draw cats.
Because cats are the greatest animal ever, other than Moopsy. which we're going to talk about in a bit. Okay, so you're working at Titmouse. So how then did you progress on to them becoming a storyboard artist for Lower Decks?
So after Titmouse, I pretty much kept working as a storyboard artist. And I went over storyboard artist / storyboard revisionist. I worked on that princess movie animatic. I then worked on Hot in Cleveland.
Okay.
For one episode, the animated episode, I storyboarded on that. And then Wendy Malick also came and played a voice on Empathological Fallacies, which I was like, that's really interesting. Yep. And then went over to that's and then DreamWorks TV was starting up at that time. So DreamWorks TV was hiring massively. And so they sort of, after I finished on Hot in Cleveland, I had a little gap. And then DreamWorks TV approached me first and was like, do you want to come in for an interview? And then hired me for something called the Ninja Team or the Hub Team. And it was basically, they saw that my portfolio had a lot of different styles and I'm able to do a lot of different things. So they could pretty much throw me to any show and I can pick up that show and fill in a gap. So that's how I ended up working on Puss in Boots. And so I worked on as a storyboard revisionist, addressing notes, also reboarding a lot of different things. Because like they were still building up their team. So sometimes feature board artists would storyboard for TV, but then feature and TV have very different demands of what they need.
Yeah.
So sometimes if we get a feature board artist and there's things missing, we have to fill in the gaps.
Gotcha.
Address executive notes and things like that. But yeah, while I was in the Hub Team, I worked on Puss in Boots. I worked on All Hail King Julian. I worked on The Croods. And then they asked if I wanted to move over to work on a show called Dino Trucks as a storyboard revisionist. And so I was there for a bit. And basically was doing a lot of reboards, but also storyboarding wherever I was needed to. The difficult thing about a show like Dino Trucks, it's like really mechanical because it's dinosaurs that are trucks and it's CG animated. And it's a lot more cinematic than you expect. So there's a lot of, you know, but there's also a lot of perspective involved. And I feel like a lot of animation is really kind of based on squishiness, like squash and stretch is one of the principles of animation.
Right.
So when you have a show that's completely the antithesis of squashing and stretching, you have,
yeah, I suppose robots and mechanics aren't that squishy.
Yeah. They're quite but solid. Then you have someone like me who's pretty much grown up on watching, you know, robots with handsome men driving them. So, so I was like, cool, yeah, I can do that. And then, moved over to a show called Spirit Riding Free. And I was there for 2 years, learned how to draw horses, which is the combination of robotic and squishy and squashy. And
it's a good mix. Like,
yeah, quadrupeds are interesting, but also now I love drawing quadrupeds because of that show. So I'm just like, when can we have a centaur episode in Lower Decks? And I'm like,
holodeck episodes. There you go, sorted.
Can't do that to the Vancouver animators. They'll all kill me. I can't be the one to do that to them. I want them to like me.
No, go on. You know you want to give them my horse.
But yeah, so then was there until I finished on Spirit, and I was there for like for two something years. Moved over to Harley Quinn for a bit. Then was majorly burnt out, so I had to take a break because I had just been going straight since the initial Titmouse gig. And then 2020 hit, and I was working on a preschool show, and I was kind of like, this isn't, but I wasn't, it wasn't like a good fit for me.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, preschool. And that's around time when I saw like Barry posted on Instagram that he's now supervising directing Lower Decks. And it was before season one was airing, but he's like, yay, season one is done. We're starting up on season two. I'm now supervising directing. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I'm like, well, I do need a job. And so I messaged Barry and I was like, hey, Barry, do you need a board artist or a revisionist? Can I come on? He's like, yeah. So we set up an interview and he's like, we don't have any board artist positions. Is it okay if you're a revisionist? I'm like, that's fine. I don't know anything about Star Trek. So this will be a great chance to learn. And it was a better fit for me in the end. And honestly, this is one of the best jobs I've ever had. So
awesome.
Like, that's how, yeah, it was a winding road, but like, you know, all the connections you meet in the beginning, you know, pay off in the end.
Yep, no, exactly. So looking at your work on Lower Decks, there are 12 episodes, 12, hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Sorry. So all 10 episodes of season 2.
Yes.
So I'm guessing that was as a revisionist rather than a storyboard artist.
Yes.
Got you. And then it was 4 episodes of season 3. Is yes. What I have down. And then we have 2, one of which is my favorite Lower Decks episode ever, of season 4.
Yes.
So with...
Wait, 2? No, wait. It would be 3.
Oh,
because there's the Moopsie episode and Pathological Fallacies and Caves.
Ah, okay, fine. Yeah. Your IMDb doesn't have Caves on it.
Ah, yeah. The IMDb, I don't know who updates that, to be honest. I don't update it.
The IMDb gods just update it, yeah.
The IMDb is just a thing that exists to me.
Got you. Oh, okay, fine. And Caves as well. Awesome. So, okay then. So before we start delving into some episode specifics, what is some of your non-Star Trek word that you're most proud of?
Non-Star Trek word that I'm most proud of. Let's see. I would say I'm actually really proud of Spirit Riding Free. There was an episode where the main character Lucky, she has to perform in the circus with her horse Spirit.
Right.
And it's sort of a combined flashback with her mom at that same circus, who also was a trick writer.
Right.
So I did a sort of combined storyboard sequence where Lucky and her mom are performing in the same space but in different parts of time.
Oh, that's cool.
And they sort of, yeah, and then there's sort of a fantasy moment where they're both on the scene at the same time and both of their horses, and then they sort of merge into one, and then one of them jumps through a ring of fire, and then she comes, and then Lucky comes out the other end. And that one I felt was like a really cool thing I got to do. It's really rare to work on a show for girls.
Yeah.
So like, being able to be on Spirit was a big, big joy because it was just so, it was so unapologetically for girls. Like, it was great. Just girl friendships, girl stories, horses, you know, super, super like unabashedly feminine and girly, and yet still really strong and really brave because they're out in the Wild West and they're having adventures and things are danger. They nearly die multiple times. So
sounds a little bit like Lower Decks.
I know. So it was, you know, really cool. That was really fun. Let's see, this isn't out yet, but I worked a bit on the Watchmen film for WB. But I got to do some cool stuff for that. I'm a big fan of Alan Moore.
Yeah.
I especially love his Promethea comic. So I know he'll never watch this movie. That's fine. But I got to, but the fact that I got to work on it is really cool. I really love, what I got to do on The Boys Diabolico. I've always wanted to work with Giancarlo Volpi, who was our supervising director, and he was also the director directly for my episode. So I got to work with him a lot and got to know him. Like, we've always kind of known each other, but I got to know him really well on this. And I'm just so proud of it because, for one thing, like, I think it's fun to try to push my boundaries of working on something that's so edgy and so dark. And it's really funny because two of us are innocent little people who have never done drugs in our entire life. And so him trying to explain to me how to take drugs was really funny. And then I had to figure out how to take drugs. The two people who have never done anything illegal ever are just like, well, how do you be edgy and take drugs?
And I now have to draw this. Yeah, okay.
I now have to draw this. And there's also like, it's also really fun to do action notes for something like that. Action notes is when you have to type out the description of what's going on.
Right.
So that it's clear, especially for an overseas animator, understanding all the subtlety and stuff like that. But yeah, it was interesting to draw, to write things. And then his intestines start flapping along the water's edge as he flies across the screen. Disemboweled. You know, various things like that. I'm just like, I'm always like, this is something that pushes the boundaries. Cool. I love being able to draw a bunch of different things and learn a lot of different things. As long as it's not a space of just like being maliciously cruel or racist or, you know, sexist or homophobic in any way. But just, you know, something like The Boys, The Boys Diabolical, which was just sort of mindless, crazy violence, but also like funny at the same time.
Yeah. So Lower Decks ticks those boxes then, because it's all a bit crazy, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Like, I've definitely drawn a lot of things for Lower Decks that I never, you know, it's fun to be like, so, you know, the first thing I got the storyboard for Lower Decks was an orgy. And it was the orgy sequence for...
Strange Energies.
Yeah, it was for I Excretus.
Yep.
And yeah, it was, and I was basically, when I got hired on for season two, I was there as a revisionist until one of the board artists, because their contract was ending early. So I was going to take that board artist's spot and storyboard for that episode. And so, yeah, one of the first assignments I got was the naked time. So I was like, okay. And, you know, just, you know, everyone is great, because the nice thing about working on productions, like, you know, that can be a bit edgy, is that people check in with you.
Yep.
And are just like, are you okay with this? And are, you know, it's like, is this something you're okay with doing? And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, the things.
Do you mind drawing all of these naked orgies? Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. And also, because we can't have overt nudity, I have to figure out how to hide people behind things and still make it look like an orgy, but also you don't see bits.
Yeah.
You don't see anything. But also, that was fun because I was like, I get to put in all the shifts. I can make it as diverse as I want. I can make it as gay as I want. I'm just like, yeah, sure. That's fine. I'm all for people consenting to having a good time together.
And that's all that matters, as long as everyone has a good time.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, but it's also fun when, like, you know, so much of animation is entertainment for children. And so whenever I bring up sometimes with a group of friends who's only worked in kids animation or feature animation, I'm like, yeah, and you know, the orgy I drew, the first orgy I drew, and then there's a second orgy that I drew in season three, the first episode.
Are horrified that you're drawing orgies, yeah.
Yeah, and they're just sitting there being like, that's a sentence I don't know if I could ever say.
Yeah. So I don't think you could probably get away with that in My Little Pony or something.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, I put that naked time sequence in my portfolio because I'm like, this is the best example of comedy that I have. I feel like it's really funny. So whoever is hiring me for a job, definitely to see my comedic chops, they have to watch that.
I love that. That's brilliant.
I'm really proud of it.
So, on that note then, so what is the favorite episode of Lower Decks that you've worked on?
So hard.
Now, whether that's a case of it's a case that you've designed something for an episode or that you just really enjoyed the story of the episode. I mean, yeah, what was your favorite episode to work on?
This is a controversial take, but I really liked, what was it? The Peanut Hamper episode in season 3.
Oh, okay.
I know, right? Everyone's always like, "What, you like that one?" And like, look, you don't understand. I got to do so many of the epic, I got to do the end, basically.
Okay.
Like, basically when the Drukmani, start attacking the village, and Peanut Hamper breaks Rada's heart, and the Cerritos has to fight the Drukmani, and the village is on fire. And I don't know. I'm not making a good case here of why I love this episode.
I suppose from an animation standpoint, there was a lot of
destruction.
That's it. And there was a lot going on as well. I mean, a destroyed village plus Drukmani plus Peanut Hamper. And yeah, there's a lot going on. So I suppose from an animation standpoint, there's actually quite a lot to do.
Yeah, it was definitely one of the most challenging assignments I ever had, but it was also the most fun I ever had because they're just like, go nuts, Gene. And I was like, great. And it came because I had been teasing the director Jason at the time, because I made all these nice cinematic shots of various ships, like the Dove in the engineering episode, and all these other times where I had all these nice cinematic shots, and they all had to get cut because of time. And so I was just like, you never let me do fun cinematic shots of ships, Jason. And then Jason's just like, who can play this game? And so he gave me all those.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. And so I was like, this is great. And I had so much fun trying to figure, and also I really loved drawing the Aerior, the bird
yes.
race.
Yeah.
Yes. I really loved drawing them. I loved drawing
the very muscular bird people, yes.
Yes, the very muscular bird people who end up, you know, flying a ship and saving their people.
Yeah, which they didn't even know they had, but anyway.
Yeah, so that was, I got to do so many cool things, but also I thought it was, I also managed to put in a lot of fun comedy in that episode too. Like when Peanut Hamper is breaking Rada's heart, like the moment where she tells him that she, you know, he's like, they've been living a lie this entire time. I had a tree crash through the scene, and that it's like that moment in The Simpsons of like, you know, you can see the moment where his heart, where you break your heart, and you see that in so much. But yeah, I just was like, this will be really funny. So I just had that tree crash into the scene of just like the final nail in the coffin of their relationship.
Oh, poor Peanut Hamper. And
yeah, poor Rada.
Yeah, true. Yeah. To be fair, I've always said Peanut Hamper was a bit of a bitch.
Yeah, she is. She is a bitchy little football with two cheese wedges on her side for her legs, which is how I drew her.
I was going to say, is that how you draw her, as a ball with little cheese wedges?
Pretty much, yeah.
I quite like
you have the complicated area to draw, but then you also, it's all balanced out by Peanut Hamper being so easy to draw. But yeah, I got to do so many cool things, like the effects of the bird about the village being set on fire from all the lasers, because it's made of wood. They actually pulled back on the destruction I did, because I was coming at it with like, this thing is made out of wood, how can it stand against lasers and technology like this? It can't, it's going to just all go up in flame. But that would have been too much work for other people, so they definitely they were right to pull back on it.
But also at the same time, how dare they.
I mean, it was the same for when I got to do the one of the scenes, season finale of season 3, when the Texas class ships are attacking Douglas Station. And I definitely, when the script says they destroy Douglas Station, I make sure to thoroughly destroy it. And apparently I wasn't supposed to destroy Douglas Station because Douglas Station is really, really big.
Yes.
And you can't just destroy with three Texas-class ships.
Although they tried.
Yeah. And so definitely that got pulled back a lot, too.
Okay, so we need some storyboard cuts then of these very destroyed versions. Like a director's cut.
The director's cut, that'd be really funny. But yeah, it's fun to draw like action sequences, like cinema. But, and also the nice thing about Star Trek is that there's a lot of ship battles, but the ship battles are very different from the way Star Wars does ship battles. They're not little zippy fighters. They're definitely, you know, I sort of think about it as great big warships.
Yes.
And it's really about the trick of cinematography on how you make it exciting.
So was it a little bit different then dealing with the Texas class? Because the Texas class was so small in comparison to, say, the Cerritos.
Definitely. Like the Texas class is a lot more zippy. And the cool fun thing about Douglas Station is that there's all these like miscellaneous things that they can zip around and blow things up. And like, you know, there was a pillar that I had fall. Blowing up Buenamigo was really fun. And the animators did such a great job. And like the Texas classes being able to be a lot more zippy made them more like, yeah, like little fighter jets, which is something I'm more used to drawing because I got interested, you know, like one of my big influences is Robotech / Macross.
Yeah.
But like, I love also drawing the bigger ship battles because then I go back to watching things like Space Battle Cruiser Yamato.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that, like Leiji Matsumoto anime series, like Galaxy Express 39. One of the crew members was like, you should watch the latest Evangelion movies now for reference for that. And the thing is, I watched Evangelion when I was young. I didn't understand it at the time because I was not mature enough to understand why this cool robot anime suddenly turned into a story about depression. And so I stopped, and then I watched it in the 90s, and then they've made movies since then. I hadn't seen any of those movies, and then it's this big thing on the crew of people who are really big Evangelion fans are just like, you can't just watch, you have to watch them all the way through. It's one of those things. And I was like, just gonna watch the fourth movie just to watch the battle sequence they're telling me about, and they're like, no, you can't do that.
You must watch all of them from start to finish. Yeah.
Yes. And I'm just like, look, I only have a limited amount of time in my day.
So what's your favorite ship to draw, or what has been your favorite ship to draw?
It was really fun drawing Rada's ship for the Aerior.
Yep.
Because it was like a croissant that I drew flying through the air.
That's a good way of looking at it, to be fair.
Yeah, and it was before we had a real solid design for it. So really, it was just a flying metal croissant. So that was fun. I also like drawing the Cerritos a lot. Like, eventually, I replaced my drawings with the blender model.
Right.
And yeah, but for roughs, like drawing the Cerritos is really fun because it's a pancake with two of those like cigar cookies
yeah
at the base. And I feel like it has such a distinctive silhouette. I'm like, that's the Cerritos. That's very clearly the Cerritos.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Because it really is just a pancake, two lines with two other lines, and that's
yeah,
the two rectangles and two lines. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fun to draw those. The shuttles are fine. I feel like they're just like a brick also on top of two sticks. But like the Cerritos, for whatever reason, I think it's because I like drawing circles. It's like really satisfying to draw.
So on the note of circles then, let's discuss I Have No Bones, Yet I Must Flee. So everyone loves Moopsie. I think we've all established that Moopsie is the greatest character of all time and will ever, for always be the greatest character of all time. and anybody can fight me for that. Who came up with the concept for Moopsy?
I think the person who wrote the episode created the Moopsy.
Right.
And so the Moopsy was already in the script when it was our turn. There was already also a rough design for the Moopsy. The design changed since when we got it. Didn't know what color it was, but did know was that it drank bones and said Moopsy. Well, actually, didn't really say Moopsy either. That sort of came in because of our voice editor, Ray. Because he recorded his son saying Moopsy, and that's how it came. For a while, actually, people thought it was me. Like the crew, whatever reason, thought it was me saying Moopsy because I said it the most to my, but also like, you know, over Zooms and stuff to everyone else, I would just occasionally just go Moopsy. So they thought it was me. Originally when Meg and I were talking about the Moopsy and various scenes, she sent me a video of a mole walking on the ground.
Right.
And yeah, apparently moles don't walk very well on ground. So they kind of go like this. They like flap. And she was like, what do you think about the Moopsy walking like this? And I'm like, I love it. And so that's why Moopsy like walked like that.
Bubbles along.
And I think because Belle O, who's the animation director, she also was assistant directing that episode.
Right.
She came up with how the Moopsy, there's when you first start learning animation, there's something called the flower bag exercise.
Right.
And you draw a bag of flower having emotions, and also like that's how you learn squash and stretch and things like that. So the Moopsy is basically a flower bag. And and so it's a, you see the Moopsy is a great example of animation principles. Because the way you see the Moopsy,
maybe we can change that then, and going forward it'd be the Moopsy exercise.
Everyone gets to draw Moopsy, that'd be great. But yeah, like the way Moopsy rolls around, the way, because you know, flapping like this isn't a very effective way to chase people. But it's hilarious because when you see the people running away screaming, and you just see this Moopsy just going like Moopsy, you know. It's even funnier because it's not trying that hard to chase them.
No. My favorite bit from that episode is when they first realize the Moopsy's got out.
Yeah.
And then the Moopsy drinks the swamp gobblers. and then finds his way out and just plops down. And it's just like, I love that. And then the fact that he plodders along and everyone runs away, and the banana in pajamas is what I like to call him, because he does look like a banana in pajamas.
I said that too as soon as he got his design. I've been saying that for years. I feel validated.
But he does. So yeah, and I can't remember his name now. My brain's gone.
Narj,
that's it. So yeah, it's just that whole bit when Narj goes, it's the most dangerous thing in here, and it's just so adorably cute. Mm-hmm. It's such a great juxtaposition to it. I love it. And then there's the whole jumping up and on the bulkhead door when they're in the control room and just bumps and he squeaks. I love that episode. It's my favorite episode. I love Moopsy.
Thank you. That was one of my favorites too. Like over season four, I had a moment of just like, I don't get to work on, you know, the Orion episode, or I don't get to work on the finale, or, you know, Nick Locarno. But then my friends who worked on those episodes, they go, you got to draw the Moopsy. And I'm like, that's true. I did get to draw the Moopsy.
Yes, that's way better than drawing Nick Locarno. Yes, 100%.
I got to draw the Moopsy eating Narj. I got to draw, like, you know, Mariner punching out all of Ransom's teeth and luring the Moopsy back.
I love that. I love that whole breadcrumb trail of teeth. So, sticking with season four, I'm going to skip over in pathological fallacies because I don't think a lot of interesting things happened in my book. It's a ship-based episode. So heading on to caves, mm-hmm. So Caves was an interesting episode. It's a bit up and down, but we get to see some very interesting aliens that we've only seen once before. Did you have a hand in sort of redesigning? Because they had a little bit of a facelift. The Vendorians we're talking about, sorry.
Ah.
So the Vendorians, because they had a little bit of a facelift. They were slightly changed from the animated series. Mm-hmm. So did you have a hand in that, or was that sort of done already?
So those that section was storyboarded by, I think it was Spencer, who did that section. I did go into that episode as an assistant director, but as people part of the story team, we don't usually have any effect on the design. The design's usually given to us by the designers. So, but I feel like looking at the original design for the Vendorians from the animated series, it really works well in our style with the way the designers designed it, because you know, I feel like our characters, you know, because like our character, our show in general, it's clearly, we're not going for realism, but there is a lot of nice realist. It's like the characters have a lot, like respond to gravity and physics enough that they're this nice, comfortable medium ground between like, they're noodly enough to be funny, but they're structural enough to be satisfying to draw for someone like me. So like, I feel like the Vendorians, the new design of the Vendorians really fits that.
It was a nice surprise to see them in the episode. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to be fair, season 4's had a lot of really good surprises, to be fair. I mean, the whole Nick Lucano subplot throughout the entire season, no one saw coming.
Yeah, I'm just kind of like poking around. I do lurk on a lot of the podcast recordings, and I lurk on Reddit. I do lurk in some of the fan spaces. I never let people know that I'm there because I feel like I don't want them to feel like they have to watch what they're saying.
Yeah.
Like, criticize the show, it's fine. Like, tell me what you want to say. I want to know everything. But yeah, no one figured out it was Nick Lucarno. And so I thought that was really interesting.
I mean, I'm gonna have to go back and rewatch season 4 and see if there are. I've been told that there are very subtle hints throughout the entire season that it is Nick Lucarno. So I'm gonna have to go back and go hunting for them, I think, just to sort of see where they are and what they are.
I feel like the key for that is definitely just looking at Mariner's journey
from
season 1. And then really thinking about how it goes to the end of season 4. And this could be because I'm on the show and I'm privy to understanding character arcs. And I definitely can just ask Mike. I'm like, well, what is the character arc for this? But when I first got on the show, and like I said, I hadn't watched a lot of Star Trek, there was required viewing before starting work on the show. And one of the required episodes that we watched was, Lower Decks, where, and then it was interesting because I was just like, our funny comedy show is based on this incredibly sad, tragic show where someone dies. A tragic episode. And I was like thinking about it. And then the more I think about it, though, the more it makes sense with Mariner's arc, because we're giving a really, like, from the beginning of the title of the show to matching the episode title and all the theories people have come up with Mariner's backstory, and Mariner even giving, like, she's been on 5 ships. People think that she might have been on the Enterprise, which I actually don't know it's true, but I think that's a really cool theory. But she has this, she has a huge, he has a long history of being in Starfleet. So yeah, she knows Riker, she knows Troy, she knows Worf,
Quark.
She was on Deep Space Nine. Yeah, she was on. She knows Nog. She knows Kira. Kira asked if they're training war stories. So Mariner's clearly seen some shit.
And
I feel like that's like the biggest hint. Like the biggest hint is that the episode title of Lower Decks, that is ultimately a hugely tragic episode that goes into, because really the series, so much of it is Mariner's entire arc, entire journey. I feel like that's, you know, it's all there, but that could also just be because I'm, you know, I connected the threads from the beginning when I started working on this show. And then when we got up to season four and I saw the scripts for the season four, the overall arc, I was like, of course it makes sense that she knew Cito Jackson. Of course it makes sense that it's Nick Locarno. But then, like I said, I could be, it's because I'm privy to this information. But I mean, I feel like some of the information is, I feel like we give a lot of it subtly.
I mean, to be fair, it's only with you saying that actually thinking about from Mariner from season one all the way through, I hadn't even thought about it that far back. But yes, you are right that Mariner's story arc from season one all the way through is that episode, which is something I had never really thought of or it hadn't really clicked until now. So thank you for that one.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, I feel like we would probably benefit. We would be a show that would definitely benefit from having more than 10 episodes per season, 100%. Because then we could really crunch down on these arcs and really just like. But like being only 10 episodes, we only have so much time and each of our episodes are only 22 minutes. You should see how much stuff we end up having to cut. And because if we were stuck in that time.
I think I can speak for every Lower Decks fan where we'd be happy to see those episodes on a Blu-ray. we would be happy for 1 hour long episodes of Lower Decks on Blu-ray.
I mean, the thing is, it wouldn't even all be animated. It would just be storyboards.
Fine.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy with that. I think everyone else will be.
I mean, if you guys want it, maybe it can happen. Star Trek fans are amazing.
I didn't expect now to get this up and running.
I mean, you guys rented a plane and everything, so I was like,
yeah,
you know, people were not expecting Nick Locarno. I wasn't expecting a plane to fly overhead. Star Trek prodigy.
So what are your hopes for the future of Lower Decks?
More seasons with more episodes. We all love working on this show.
Yeah.
It makes me sad whenever like I finish a season and I don't know if we're going to get another one.
Yeah.
Because so pretty much when like we have a little mantra of every season finale is a series finale because we never know if we're going to get another season. So whenever I find out we get a season, it's when everyone else finds out. So I'm just like, yay.
Well, hopefully everything from today onward should be back to a little bit of normality. We might get some inklings that season five will be coming out, will be commissioned.
Well, season five is in production right now. So season five is definitely going to come out at some point.
Or even better hopefully. Then, fine.
Yes, but yeah, we don't know if season six is going to happen. So hopefully season six will happen.
Well, and we want seven seasons.
We get season seven.
Well, we want seven seasons of 24 episodes. So we need 14 seasons with seven.
I would also love to work on a movie version.
I would love a feature film length, 2 hour long Lower Decks episode. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. I would love to see how we tie up various things because there's a lot of threads in the show that I don't even know what's going to happen.
So I want to know what happens with Tendi.
Yeah.
And I want her to marry Rutherford. That's the end game.
I got to say, like, people on the crew, we have our own ships. And it's not canon because it's just our personal headcanons.
Yeah.
But, like, there's, but, yeah, there's so many things that we kind of go, like, oh, it'd be nice if this happens. Oh, it'd be nice if this happens. Everything like that. So,
we also need to see the Enterprise E.
Yeah, I would love sort of like my secret episode is like for whatever reason, Michael Burnham and Mariner get stuck together in sort of an odd couple situation.
Oh, that
where they're like
incredible.
Yeah, they're like handcuffed together and they're just stuck together in some way and they have to figure out a way to work together because Michael Burnham is order and Mariner is chaos.
I would love to see that episode. Time travel. It opens up so many doors. It's brilliant.
I also want Ethan Peck to come back and be in one of our episodes. And poor Spock having to be on the Cerritos. I just think it'd be really fun.
Yeah, so yeah, because you guys you did all the animation, didn't you, for Those Old Scientists, for the end scene, as it were, where they.
So that actually happened when we were in between seasons. So yeah, Titmouse did do it, but it was mostly our Vancouver team who handled it, and they handled it like, oh, so good.
It was
Just
brilliant.
chef's kiss. Yeah.
I
But
loved
that's
the
actually
opening
neat.
titles.
Yeah, aren't they great?
They were
We even
awesome.
got the nacelles,
Plug.
the cell alien on there.
Yeah.
That's so good. It was really funny because I knew about it really early.
Just couldn't say
And
anything.
yeah, no, I couldn't say anything for ages. And finally they released it at Comic-Con. I was like, I'm free. I can talk about it now. But I got to meet our cast for the first time at Star Trek Las Vegas,
Awesome.
and I got to meet some of the Strange New Worlds cast, including like Christina Chong, Ethan Peck. They were all so lovely, and they were like, "We had so much fun with, Lower Decks," and they're like, "Can we come in?" I was like, "Dude, it was not up to me, but I would totally love
I met
it."
Christina, so she was back over here this summer, and she was in at Destination Star Trek this year. So I met Christina this year. She's incredible. She's lovely. Because obviously she's local to us. She lives about four. She lives
Gotcha.
about an hour and a half away from me. So, which is awesome. So, are you planning to go to Star Trek Las Vegas next year?
I don't know. I want to see what kind of I this the, it was exciting because I had been working on this show for 3 years, but because of COVID, I haven't been able to go to any conventions or anything.
Yeah.
So I finally reached a point where I'm just like, I'm going. And I was very determined to go because I was like, I want to see cosplay with my two eyeballs.
To
I
be fair,
want to
that's
see
exactly what
cosplay.
I'm doing. This next year will be the first year that I'm going to Star Trek Las Vegas. So
Oh,
I'm flying over from the UK and we're spending a week in Vegas. It's going to be awesome.
that sounds great. Okay, maybe I will have to seriously consider. Like the big thing, one of the big reasons I went this year, I know Todd Stashwick, who plays, Captain Shaw, and he goes to he and I go to the same gym, and the owners of our gym are good friends. And so, like, they were all going to go to
Do
support
you
Todd,
play
and so I
D&D
tagged
with Todd
along.
Stashwick? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't, but I definitely want to. Like, Titmouse has this real, Titmouse has a giant D&D room
Right.
that, and like, we have a, it's like there's a table with like a whole setup and everything with figures and things like that. And it's like the secret room because there's a secret door, but we're all allowed to borrow the room for D&D. So I kind of have a dream of like inviting Todd and a bunch of other people from our gym who all play D&D, and I don't have to play. I just want to watch them use the
I
table. Yeah,
would love to just sit in that room and watch them play. It'd be great.
I brought the Moopsie in with me into the D&D room, so put them on the Dungeon Master's chair, and then like put them on the parts of the table, eat, destroying the figures and stuff. Eating, drinking their bones.
Love it. Absolutely love it. So, do you hope that you'll be able to direct an episode? Or are
I
you
think it'd
quite,
be.
do you want, or do you prefer staying animating?
I honestly, I wouldn't mind directing an episode of Lower Decks. Directing, like the intimidating thing about directing an animation is that you're sort of you're the person who puts out all the fires, and you're jumping from fire to fire to fire, and it's an incredibly demanding job. But Lower Decks is a great show that people can learn on, and there's room for people to make mistakes on. And it's hard to find a production that's so supportive. And that's why I felt really safe asking to move up on Lower Decks to assistant director from storyboarding. Like I can hop back and forth from storyboard to revision to storyboard to revision. As much as there's a lot more safety in that, but like when you try to take on more responsibility, there's definitely an aspect where, especially entertainment involves so much money and then not enough time, that like mistakes can really hurt you. So inexperience is always sort of can be sort of a detriment. But like being on a show like Lower Decks, where it's like, yeah, it's fine, you'll be guided through. I have such a great support system on this show that like, yeah, I'd be so open to maybe trying to direct, because
Awesome.
I know that if I mess up, there'll be people to give me a hand. I personally relate a lot to Mariner because I've definitely been offered directing spots before and I just turned them down. Like it happened a lot, especially during the pandemic, and I didn't feel safe enough to direct. For one thing, like having to direct over Zoom from home when I'm so used to being in a studio space where I can just walk over to anyone and ask for what I need. So I didn't think it was something for it was I it was something I was like, I'm not into taking a risk right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, like Mariner is definitely the character I relate to the most in our show. So I put in a lot of myself in Mariner when I draw her. So like, but yeah, being in a safe space where you're seen as who you are,
yeah,
and appreciated for your ideas and for, you know, even if it's a little bit against the grain, even if it's not always like the first thought that people think of, like, but you're supported and seen through it. Like Ransom's radical support is definitely something I feel on this show. Yeah. So having the radical support of my team, I'm just like, yeah, I think I could direct an episode on Lower Decks.
There we go. So hopefully season 5 or even season 6, it will be a reality.
Fingers crossed. It'd be really cool. I mean, if I could direct like a special, it'd be fun.
That'd be awesome. You have been incredibly generous with your time. So I have one last question for you. It's super easy. It doesn't need any thought whatsoever. But Gene Kang, what does Star Trek mean to you?
Oh, boy.
Told you, it's an easy one.
Yeah. Star Trek to me means, I would say hope for the future. Like hope for a future that is, you know, post-scarcity. Everyone has what they need. We all are able to see each other more empathetically as humans, accept differences, accept that differences make things more interesting and make things much more fun. And be able to keep exploring and explore differences, explore similarities, and just keep learning. I think that is what Star Trek means to me.
That's incredible. I love that. Gene, thank you so much for your time. To everyone watching and listening, thank you for joining us this week. And you can catch up with more Clone Star Podcast at clonestarpod.com for blogs and fan art done by you, our fans. Until next time, have a great week ahead, everyone.